Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Last Saturday, I attended a rally at the State House calling for justice in the case of Sinze Reed, the 13-year-old Columbus resident who was murdered by a neighbor last October, but whose killer is currently not facing charges. Reed was a resident of a Columbus neighborhood or apartment complex in an area without much in the way of social services. Infrastructure or resources like grocery stores that the rest of us take for granted. His family claims he was unarmed at the time and that the neighbor, Craig Butler, shot Reed multiple times with no apparent motive before fleeing the scene. Butler, once arrested, claimed self-defense, invoking Ohio's newly adopted Stand Your Ground law. Murder charges initially filed against Butler were dropped and he was released within 24 hours, according to members of Reed's family who spoke on Saturday. Reed was black and Butler is white. Butler is on probation, or was on probation at the time, following a conviction for domestic violence and child endangerment. And though federal law prohibits convicted violent felons from possessing a gun, state and local laws do not. Butler's probation officer and the newly elected county prosecutor, Gary Tyack, opted not to detain Butler, pending a coroner's report, which is expected to take weeks or months, despite the fact that Reed's body was already cremated. Here's the sound I gathered from the rally on Saturday.
My name is Ramon Obey. First name is spelled R-A-M-O-N. Last name is spelled O-B-E-Y. I'm with the organization Justice, Unity, and Social Transformation, better known as Just 614.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on out here.
Today you're seeing a movement of people take the streets for Sinze Reed. We're out here to get justice for Sinze. We're out here advocating for the family. We're out here advocating for the neighborhood and for the community of Wedgewood. We're out here as a group doing what we believe is necessary in order for Sinze Reed to get justice.
Hoping to raise awareness then? Hoping that...
We're definitely hoping to raise awareness. We're hoping to give the family the opportunity to tell more people Sensei's story. And we're hoping to show the contradictions of our court system and of our police force as well.
Why did you choose the State House? Because this is a county issue, right?
That's correct. It is a county issue. However, we chose the State House because we have a lot of elected officials in that State House who aren't representing us right now. And we believe that we have to hold everybody accountable in order for Sensei to get justice. This isn't just about Sinze. This is about Sinze, his neighborhood, his family, the community of Wedgewood. And there are so many different things related to this case that it would be foolish for us not to understand that by taking over the State House, the Columbus Police Headquarters, wherever we go, there's definitely some contradictions there that we need to raise in order for people to understand that Sinze needs justice, the community needs justice, and his family needs justice.
The police reports and media reports so far leave a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of the shooting. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything more than what's been reported?
We know what the family has said, we know what the eyewitnesses have said, and we know what the police reports have said. And we believe that is enough information for us currently to believe that Craig Butler is guilty, he needs to be in prison, that this is not a proper cause or a proper case for someone to say that we are just standing our ground. We believe that what Craig Butler did was a modern day lynching of Sinze Reed, and because of that, we need to be out here and we need to advocate hard for Sinze.
Did Craig Butler and Sinze Reed, were they acquainted prior to this?
From speaking with his mother, the information that we have received is that they did not know each other at all.
And what can you speculate as to Butler's motives for shooting him then?
I'm not sure what his motives are. From what, you know, to shoot a 13-year-old kid, you have to have some pretty sick motives, you know. And I think by giving Craig any type of leeway in any of this, we are doing this family an injustice, and that's something we're not here to do.
This is my first time here. Are these all family members here in the front?
You see, family, friends, community. That's what we got. I will be there at the city council meeting January 9th at 5 p.m. We're inviting the whole community to come out. Our goal with going to the city council meeting is, again, to raise the contradictions that the city council has constantly have tried to advocate for within these neighborhoods. You know, when we look at these neighborhoods, we're seeing police cameras. We're seeing them occupied heavily by the police force. And what we need to do is not just occupy this community. We need to put resources in these communities. The West Side is usually seen as a food desert. We need to put grocery stores. We need social services that people can actually use within these neighborhoods. We don't need more police cameras. We don't need more heavily armed police officers within those neighborhoods. We need actual help. We need affordable housing. That's what I'm talking about. When I say Sensei's case is connected with so many different things, that's exactly what I mean. There's so many intersections that we need to understand when it comes to Sensei. This is a kid who grew up in a poor neighborhood. He grew up in an area that is drowning in crime and violence. And just thinking that we're going to put more police cameras in that neighborhood or more occupying police force in that neighborhood, we would be stupid and foolish to think that that's what's going to work and that's what's going to save the neighborhood of Wedgwood. I've not heard back from Gary Tyack. And what she's referring to is on... Thursday, we went to the prosecutor's office with a letter of demands. That letter of demands was handed right over to Gary Tyack's first assistant. We were very proud to be able to meet with Gary Tyack's first assistant, but we were met with a bad attitude. We were met by somebody who doesn't seem to care about the community, and that's exactly the people we need to be protesting and getting out of office. People who are not speaking for the community and aren't working with the community to provide actual resources and information on what's going on with this Craig Butler case. All we're asking for when it comes to the city prosecutor's office, or the county prosecutor's office, excuse me, is information related to this case. We want it to be as open as possible. And if it's not open, then we believe that they are withholding information from the community. When the mom was buying clothes for her son's funeral, Craig Butler was released as a free person. And they didn't even call the mom to give her the necessary information to let her know that Craig Butler was moving around freely. We find that to be... A big danger to the community and to the family, and we can't stand on that. And we can't stand on that one. We need to move on that one.
The prosecutor has stated that the reason they're not pressing charges against Mr. Krieg at the moment is because they can't prosecute a felony case. Has anyone looked into that? Is that a viable explanation in your view?
Can you repeat that real quick for me?
Gary Tyack, the prosecutor, yes, has stated that the reason they're not pressing charges against Krieg Butler is because they cannot prosecute a felony case. Is that valid?
They should be able to prosecute a felony case. I'm not sure if they're able to prosecute a federal case. I know that we have to wait on the grand jury and make sure that these officers who work at CPD are collecting as much evidence as necessary. Right now, I've heard that they're waiting on the autopsy to figure out exactly where the bullets were fired into Sensei's body. If the autopsy shows that he shot downward, then it kind of wipes away his ability to say that this was in self-defense. However, again, we're talking about the Franklin County commissioner or a Franklin County prosecutor not giving the family the necessary information to keep up with them and make sure that they're safe. We're talking about, again, we were just there on Thursday. We're just talking about on Thursday. We went to the office already, and we were met with bad attitudes and bad actors, and we need to work hard to get these people out of office. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Yep.
When black lives are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. When black lives are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
When black lives are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
Say his name,
Sensei Reed.
Say his name,
Sensei Reed.
Bring the family up real quick. Come on, Megan. And Michaela and cousins and community as well. Let's all join Megan up here as well to show that support system. It's always important that we show that this young boy had a family that loved him and had a community that loved him. He wasn't just out here by himself. This is Megan Reed. This is Sensei's mom. I want you guys to be respectful as she gets ready to speak. After Megan, we will be having Michaela, Sensei's sister, speak as well.
Say thank you to everyone who took the time of the day to help me get justice for my baby. Me, my family, and most importantly, today, are so honored to have all of you on this journey with us. the justice system has not only failed me and my baby, but a lot of the other families out there too. Truth be told, if Craig was Tyrone and today was little Billy, we wouldn't even be out here today. Because today we've already had justice. Today's story has been seen and heard all over the world because of everyone standing here, and I will forever be grateful for that. No one should have to lose their baby or any member of their family and then have to fight for justice, which should automatically be given. So once again, I want to say thank you for all of you being out here today, and together we will get justice for today and all of the families that deserve justice too. Forever Mondo the baby, forever 13. Thank you.
Justice for Sensei Reed!
Justice for Sensei Reed!
Justice for Sensei Reed!
Justice for Sensei Reed!
Say his name.
Is out here today because I'm seeing faces that I've never seen before. Like, we did this, like, at least this is probably, like, what, six, seven times? Like, our sixth, seventh time we've been out here trying to get justice for Sensei Reed. And it's never been this good of a turnout. Like, I'm really proud with seeing all these faces and y'all getting Sensei's name heard. Like, he don't deserve this. He didn't deserve this at all. Like, Craig Butler killed Sensei cold blood, shot him in his right hand, his back. No, he was unarmed. How is it self-defense? Like, I don't understand how they claim self-defense, and I'll keep saying it until I understand. They never gave us no explanation. The mom's a witness, and the mom wasn't there at the scene. Like, how is she a witness and wasn't even at the scene? I don't understand it. Like, self-defense, like, I didn't know a 13-year-old child could kill himself. Like, that's what y'all's putting it out to right now. Like, y'all saying he pulled the trigger on himself. Like, nobody's getting in trouble for this. Nobody's behind bars for my 13-year-old brother's murder. Like, he was murdered in cold blood, unarmed. Like, we shouldn't even be standing out here right now. Like, why are we fighting for a 13-year-old child that was unarmed? Why do we gotta fight for justice for? Like, do any of y'all understand that right now? Like, he was 13, unarmed, got shot in his right hand, in his back. Like, I don't understand, man. Like, we won't stop until we get our justice. They made us stop, told us we had to wait, get evidence back, get the autopsy back. My brother is already in his urn. Like, and it's sad as fuck to say, but he's already in his urn. What are we waiting for? The autopsy, it's been 3 months. It's been 3 months. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why we're still waiting for evidence, still investigating on a 13-year-old's case. Like, when y'all pulled up to that crime scene, was Craig Butler there still? Did he wait at that crime scene when he killed my little brother? No, he got in his truck. He left the scene. SWAT had to hit. They hit his sister's house a whole day later just to find him. But self-defense when he got in his truck and ran and hid for a whole 24 hours and my baby brother was already dead an hour later. He made it to the hospital. Didn't have a chance to fight. He shot him 4 or 5 times. Like, self-defense, and he really shot up my brother. Like, it wasn't one bullet. It wasn't none of that. He shot out of my brother. Like, sad to say, a 13-year-old child was shot to death, and his killer is out here just walking freely, spending time with his family, with his baby mom, which, don't let me pass this, his baby mom that he has DV charges on, his kids that he has child endangerment charges on. He's free, and he's on probation when he murdered my little brother. Like, I get it's a open carry, whatever, but I didn't know it was an open carry when he was on probation. Like, I didn't know that. I don't think I'm wrong about that, which I really don't know my laws or none of that real good. That's why I haven't been good with trying to get Sensei's name out there, because we really don't know nobody. That's why I'm really thankful that people are finally hearing us, because we really didn't know how to get his name out here. We really was just standing out here with this group right here. Like, we need more people to get Sensei's name out here, because this is not even the half of the story, y'all. Like, there's so much of this story that they just let go under the dirt. Like, they just swept it by as self-defense and didn't even talk to his mother, let the man out of jail, and came back to where he killed Sensei and We still to this day don't know why he killed Tenseiso. How do we know he wasn't going to get out of jail and come to his mom's house? Or, you know, like, they let him out and just let him free back to where he killed, where we were staying at, where he killed our little brother at. Like, the whole situation, the whole case don't make sense. And we will not stop. We will keep fighting until Sensei Reed has justice. Until Craig Butler is in prison because he is literally a beast. He killed a 13-year-old child unarmed in the back, in the right hand. There's no more to say to that. We should not be fighting. There's no more to say to that. The child was unarmed. Sensei Reed was unarmed, got shot in his right hand, which means he was holding his hands up. He was telling him to stop. He was telling him, like, put his hands up, turned around, and Craig got out of his truck and was still shooting on my little brother. Like, we should not be fighting for this right now. We will not stop until Sensei has peace. And once again, I want to thank all the cameras, all the people out here, all the news reporters, because y'all need to post that. Y'all need to make the report, because this is not right. We need more people to hear this, like, famous people that posted Sensei Reed. Like, this is not right. But Craig Butler is still walking out here. Like, I know we're being heard, but they don't hear us. The law don't hear us. The prosecutor don't hear us. The judge don't hear us. So we won't stop until they hear us, because Craig Butler deserves to be rotten in prison because my little brother is gone. His mom just had his first Christmas without him. His blood little sister just had her first Christmas without her little brother, without her big brother. How do y'all think she feels right now? And this man has having Christmas with his little kids that he beat on, with his baby mama he beat on. Like, he's just... he's a menace to society, and I don't know how they don't see that.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now! What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If Craig Butler was black and Sensei was white, would Craig Butler be in prison?
Yeah.
Hell yeah!
Craig Butler is 6'3". 200 pounds, and he was able to claim self-defense.
On a 5 feet, not even 100 pounds, 13-year-old.
5 feet, not even 100 pounds, 13-year-old boy. He had prior convictions. Convictions that, mind you, a lot of these news organizations haven't brought up fully, but if this was us, they no doubt would have brought up those convictions immediately. This is a man who doesn't take care of his kids. Speaking with people in the neighborhood, apparently he has 10 kids, and he's not in the life of any of them. Again, this is something that they would have brought up on any of us out here. They would have came and they would have slandered us. They would have did everything possible to put guilt on us. In fact, they're doing everything possible to put guilt on this family and to that community as I'm speaking today. The community has had house raided by police, CPD, looking for guns that do not exist.
Got kicked out of my home because SWAT hit it looking for a gun that was never there. That was never there. They're coming at his family and not coming at Craig's family, letting Craig's family text the mom, make Facebook posts about us, police hitting our cribs, trying to look for a gun that was never there, like, but doing all this, but saying nothing about Craig and his past and his family, his charges, his probation officer. When we asked the prosecutor about the case, she said the probation officer looked it over and dropped it. Like, I didn't understand that part.
We've had witnesses be threatened by the Columbus Police Department. They're showing up, trying to, you know, go after them. Is this really what happened? Are you sure this is what happened? Well, we have some people who are saying things differently, yet these people who are saying things differently are unfounded. We don't know where they at. This community is being terrorized by the Columbus Police Department. This community has been terrorized before the Columbus Police because we understand what Wedgwood is, right? Have you ever been to Wedgwood? Let me ask y'all that.
Yes.
Let me turn to this community right here, because this is the community of Wedgwood. Wedgwood is a food desert, am I lying? No. Y'all ain't got nothing. There's no really grocery stores in that area, is there? No. Wedgwood is a place with a high rate of crime, am I lying? Wedgwood's educational system is failing. Am I lying? The reason I'm bringing all of this up is because Sensei had to grow up into those conditions. And we must understand what these conditions can do to people, especially when these are the outcomes to these conditions. When we are fighting for the whole community of Wedgwood, we understand Sensei might have been the first,
But if we don't stand up for that community, he won't be the last. So Sensei has a younger sister and an older brother. Our goal here today is one, to get justice for Sensei, but two, to get to protect that community, protect that family, and make sure that they're able to grow old. The Columbus Police Department just put up 12 to 15 police cameras around Wedgwood. That's an occupation. They're occupying that neighborhood as we speak. These are reactionary practices going into a neighborhood that needs real solutions. They need social services within these neighborhoods. They need actual grocery stores within these neighborhoods. They need programs for the kids within these neighborhoods.
They need to get the murderer out that neighborhood. He's still living in that neighborhood. Craig Butler is still living there.
Craig Butler should be in prison.
Wedgwood should have at least kicked him out for killing somebody on the property, I don't think. For having being armed on their property where hella kids live, like, something should have happened. But no, he's still living there. He's still freely living there around a whole bunch of other 13-year-old children. White, black, all colors.
And I'm going to tell a story that Megan was nice enough to share with me. Craig Butler was released, and the family didn't even know about it. And when they found out, Megan was buying clothes for Sensei's funeral and got a call from a community member that said, Craig Butler is free and we've seen him in this neighborhood.
That ain't right.
Think about those conditions.
Like I said, we still to this day don't know why Sensei was killed. How do we know he wasn't coming after us? We don't know. We didn't know. They still haven't let us know except self-defense on an unarmed child, a child that's literally right-handed and got shot in his right hand.
Based off
his and his mother's mouth, that and his mother wasn't even there. Like, literally, it says his mother is a witness. His mother was not there.
And that's another thing. His mom wrote a note stating that Craig Butler was in self-defense. We gotta break that one. That would not fly for anybody out here of color if our moms had wrote us a note saying that we were acting in self-defense. In fact, if there was ever a force of privilege within the self-defense law that just recently got passed, is the fact that they were able to take that information to release him. That's a privilege we just don't have within our own community.
They released them before they got the witness of the mother. They released them when his own mouth said self-defense. Wow. Like, you didn't look at nothing, none of that. Since they didn't have a gun on him, none of that. But if he did, like, how do you know Craig didn't shoot at him first? Like, you still didn't get nobody's story except that white man, and then you let that white man out. You didn't get nobody else's story, didn't tell nobody else, just thought what he said was true. It takes 24 hours to investigate all that, blah, blah, blah. They're still investigating. Why is this man not locked up still? Like, I seriously never in my life saw somebody, heard of somebody killing somebody and then literally getting out of jail until the case is solved, whatever. Like, what? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't.
So we got four demands. Demand number one is the immediate arrest of Craig Butler. We got to get him off the streets. He's a clear danger to our community, and we have to protect our community. Number two, we are asking that Gary Tyack and Marla Farbacker removed themselves both from office. Gary Tyack is the county prosecutor. Marla Farbacker is the one who's over the grand jury. Just really quick, going back to Gary Tyack, I can ask most of the people here, even within this audience, has Gary Tyack done anything for Casey Goodson Jr.?
No.
Has Gary Tyack done anything for Andre Hill?
Hell no.
Has Gary Tyack done anything for Donovan Lewis?
Hell no.
Has Gary Tyack done anything to help this family?
Hell no.
Gary Tyack, it's time to go.
Gotta go.
Number three, we are asking for an apology from the city of Columbus to this family. It's one thing not to give them all the facts surrounding the case because you got some ridiculous protocol. It's another thing not to let the family know that the person who killed their son is at home free. It's another thing to hide information that goes for their own safety. That's ridiculous. And as a city, we need to do better at picking who our public officials are. And if that means voting every single one of them out of office and mobilizing against every single one of them, then that's what we have to do as a community. Number four, we are asking for a DOJ investigation into the city's police force as well as its judicial system as well. We've been asked for a DOJ investigation. We were given
DOJ investigation in which the Mayor Ginther was able to just push through. I'm losing the words for it. It wasn't a full basically, the DOJ investigation we got now is not a full-fledged DOJ investigation. They're just going through the books. We don't need them to go through the books. We need them to actually be hand down recommendations and then the city to follow those recommendations so our black asses aren't getting lynched by people like Craig Butler. Say his name.
Say
his name.
Say his name.
Next up, we got Sierra, who's going to speak a little bit as well. When we're out here for Sensei, again, it's important that we, one, get justice for this family. If you have money to donate, we got a GoFundMe set up for the family. All you have to do is type in Sensei's name, give money. My personal goal for this family is to move them out of Wedgwood. Let's get them to a safer community, a place where those kids can actually grow up, a place where they don't have to worry about state and city violence affecting them. And we want them as far away from where that murder took place. She shouldn't have to be driving by the place where her son was killed by Craig Butler on a daily basis. So if you have any money to give, there's a GoFundMe for Sensei Reed. Please, please give to this family.
I'm so sorry that we have to be here today. So I didn't know anything about Wedgwood before this case. And when I visited last week to come and support the family and the things that all of the amazing activists are doing in your community, I was shocked. I didn't expect to walk into such a movie because I've really never seen a community that looked like that in real life, where you truly see mattresses and just trash, and you know, you can just tell the lack of resources that's within this community. And I think that that's something so important to talk about because we truly are a product of our communities. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of exceptions to that, but that's on an individual basis. When we look at entire communities and how, you know, we support them, and when we don't put and allocate resources into certain communities, they fail. And that's exactly what the city did to this family. And that's what the city is continuing to do to this, the entire community. It reminds me a lot of what's going on in Canton, because there's a lack of resources in, you know, the aspect of not having food in certain areas and like just not having the resources and like community centers and things for children to do after school. I mean, if we think about the resources that could be there, if there was a community center in this community, Sensei may not have even been, you know, walking home because he might have been, you know, in a resource and utilizing something that was, you know, getting him to a point of success. And so I think it's super important not only to, you know, move this family and get them away from the trauma and the lack of resources, but also to rehabilitate the community. And so I do want to remind everybody and say thank you for not only being here, but continue to support the entire community, because it's not just Sensei's family that's suffering. You know, we're all here today because we feel for this family and we have a passion for what we fight for. And it's time to fight for not only this family, but their entire community, because they're not the only ones that face trauma in this incident. Justice for Sensei Reed.
Justice for Sensei
Reed.
Say his name.
Say his name.
Say his name.
Say his name.
I can't hear you.
Say his name.
Say his name.
Before you get mobile, there's one more thing we need to touch on. Stand Your Ground recently passed here. And Ohio, it's over all of Ohio. We have to educate ourselves on Stand Your Ground, because it's no longer protecting the victim, it's protecting the aggressor. And when laws like these pass, it affects our community, black, brown, poor, whatever, communities first. And we're seeing that in real time. Please continue to call Gary Tyack's office. The man that he resigned from that position, the man that he replaced Marla Farbacher, the man that all of those people whose carryover from those Ronald Bryan years also leave office as well. That office has a long history of racism within the city of Columbus. Call Mike DeWine as well. Ask Mike DeWine if this is what he meant when he passed the Stand Your Ground law. Write letters to your elected officials.
There's always something we can be doing, and we always need to be mobile.
News since the start of the year has been cautiously optimistic regarding the U.S. economy, but not so much for the rest of the world, as inflation, which is global, threatens to force dozens of debtor nations into default, possibly accelerating world poverty and hunger. That, in turn, drives global economic displacement. Nevertheless, inflation in the U.S. appears to be slowing slightly, and the Federal Reserve is expected to ease off a bit on its periodic increases in the interest rate. Meanwhile, countries in Central America and Africa are clamoring for a democratic governance and are running into a familiar pattern of interference from forces allied with the United States. Brazil saw a group of violent insurrectionists storm several government buildings, claiming the recent election was illegitimate. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, fled all the way to Florida, to Trump's Mar-a-Lago, to be precise. The recent ouster of Peru's arguably inept but elected president has sparked intense protests, which have been met with force by police and the military there. Similar unrest has hit Bolivia and Ecuador. Are these signs of a global upheaval, not just of a sociopolitical nature, but for a more just economic system? Richard Wolff is an economist and a host of the weekly program Economic Update. News since the start of the year has been cautiously optimistic regarding the U.S. economy, but not so much for the rest of the world, as inflation, which is global, threatens to force dozens of debtor nations into default, possibly accelerating world poverty and hunger. That, in turn, drives global economic displacement. Nevertheless, inflation in the U.S. appears to be slowing slightly, and the Federal Reserve is expected to ease off a bit on its periodic increases in the interest rate. Meanwhile, countries in Central America and Africa are clamoring for a democratic governance and are running into a familiar pattern of interference from forces allied with the United States. Brazil saw a group of violent insurrectionists storm several government buildings, claiming the recent election was illegitimate. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, fled all the way to Florida, to Trump's Mar-a-Lago, to be precise. The recent ouster of Peru's arguably inept but elected president has sparked intense protests, which have been met with force by police and the military there. Similar unrest has hit Bolivia and Ecuador. Are these signs of a global upheaval, not just of a sociopolitical nature, but for a more just economic system? Richard Wolff is an economist and a host of the weekly program Economic Update.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, debts, incomes, our own and our children's. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Today's program is about the decline of U.S. capitalism, and I mean that seriously in a way that I haven't before, even though I've mentioned the idea. What do I mean by the decline of U.S. capitalism? Well, I mean that there are signs that could be read, and I believe should be read, as symptoms of that decline. That we were finished just now choosing between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, as if those were the best this system could do at a moment of crisis, which would be a stretch, I think most of you would agree. That we have failed to deal with a public health emergency on a scale that would embarrass any country, but for one of the richest countries in the world to have made such a mess at its own peril and at the cost now of almost a quarter of a million people dying, that's a sign that the footprint of the United States in the world economy is really less than it was 10 years ago, and even less than what it was 20 years ago. That's a sign of something. And I think more and more Americans recognize it, that American dream we thought was our heritage is now out of reach of the vast majority of people, that the standard of living is threatened at every turn, that we have a million less people producing public services in this country than we did in February of this year. At a time when we need public services more than ever, we have less than what... There are too many signs, and I think they point to something that we can and should call the decline of American capitalism. Well, some of you may wonder, how could we talk about decline? Isn't the United States extremely powerful these days? Yes, it is extremely powerful, but that's not really relevant. Let me remind you, feudalism came into the world around 500, 600 AD, at least into the European part of the world. And it lasted 1,000 years. And at the end of feudalism, just before it died, was its time of greatest power. Those absolute monarchies, you know, Louis the 14th or Louis the 16th or the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the British Empire, those were at the end. Those were the coming to fruition of a feudalism just before it died. So seeing a powerful America on one hand doesn't really refute anything about a notion of decline. What about warfare? We haven't won the war in Afghanistan, not even close. And we haven't won the war in Iraq either. And that means something. Those are two of the poorest countries on the face of the earth. And they've been able, those that were the enemies of the United States, to stay in large part controlling their territories. That means something. And we know economically that we now have a real competitor in the People's Republic of China that has been gaining on the United States for 30 years. I could go on, but I think the case for decline might be better made if I talk to you about something that's true of all economic systems in any country where they have arisen and developed over time and then died. That's the pattern, folks, of every economic system in every country. It's born out of something else. It emerges and develops and changes over time. And then it passes away. And there is no reason, and there never was, why capitalism in the United States should display any different pattern from all the others. So let's review. And let's begin by talking about U.S. capitalism's beginnings. Well, here in the United States, we didn't always have capitalism. You all know that. We had tribal societies here, what we call the Native Americans, who lived in kinds of arrangements that didn't include hiring and firing people, no wage labor, no capitalist, no profit, none of it. Native Americans lived in completely different ways. So how did capitalism come here? How was it born? Well, basically was brought here by Europeans who imposed it, who planted it here. And when it began, it was poor and backward and small and weak. It was part of the colonial time when a big, powerful country, Britain, established colonies here. And within those colonies, both before and after our independence, small capitalists emerged. Capitalism emerged, you know, out of what? Mostly out of self-employed people who didn't hire anyone, who were little peasants and little craftsfolks in New England and the other parts of the eastern coast where it all began. And that's where capitalism was born. And like most newborns, it was weak and wobbly, and it needed a lot of help. And a lot of that help was provided, as always, by the government. The British government when we were a colony, the American government when we were independent. And first and foremost, it was the government that snatched the land away from those other people who organized themselves in a pre-capitalist, non-capitalist way. Those people were either pushed away or destroyed. The land was taken, and a different economic system from what they had was implanted. That's how capitalism grew. And ironically, because it killed so many of the Native Americans, the capitalism that was born in the United States immediately had a terrible problem: labor shortage. You can't have capitalism with an employer and an employee if you don't have an employee. And the Native Americans weren't about to be employees for a whole host of reasons. They didn't want it, and the colonists arriving didn't trust them and often killed them. So how'd you solve the problem? You brought wave after wave of immigrant to this country to be the employees. You had to have that, otherwise they wouldn't have lived a capitalist system here. And you had to solve the problem of how could you make this capitalism work, not just needing labor, but you needed a market. What would you produce and to whom would you sell it? And yeah, you could sell a little bit to each other, but you couldn't get a successful, let alone a rich capitalism going like that. And they hit upon a solution. The British, of course, because they ran the show. They needed something. Why? Because the biggest industry in England at the beginning of the United States was cotton textiles. That's what made the British Empire the powerhouse that it was. But cotton doesn't grow in England. It's too cold. It's too rocky. It's too wet. They had to find a place to grow the cotton, to buy the cotton, to bring it to England, to make the textiles that made the British Empire. And that's where the United States came in. In the South, you can grow cotton and sell it to England. That gives you something to sell to make money, good money, because the British would buy it because it was within their empire. You lacked nothing except one thing, labor again. So how'd you solve the problem? The government got to work and created a safe way to bring masses of people by taking over military strength, snatching Africans then, African Americans now, and bringing them over by force and making them work in the cotton fields by force and threat and intimidation and oppression and all the rest of it, with a system of government to enforce it, to enforce slavery, to bring back the runaway slave, to require. You get the picture? Capitalism develops at every step with reliance on the power of the government. But it works. It produces a wealthy United States capitalism. And as it grows, it doesn't want to be under the control of the English because they tax you and they snatch away parts of it and they monopolize what you're selling and give you a crappy price. So you break away in an independence war. Now you can be more your own master. That's a military battle fought by the government to fight against the British, to give you the space to grow. Yeah, the government helps you develop capitalism. And then it grows, and the British are angry. You know what they accuse Americans? Stealing British technology, stealing intellectual development from Britain, which of course they did. They had learned in England. They came from England. You know, it reminds me of the charges against the People's Republic of China coming from the United States, which literally reproduced what the British said about the United States a little while earlier. It makes no difference. That kind of information passes, and you can't stop it. The British couldn't stop the Americans from copying and developing from those copies, and we can't stop the Chinese any better than we stopped the Japanese before them, etc. And capitalism grew in America. And as it grew, it outgrew its own parent, as children often do. We became bigger and richer than the British. But there was another country doing it at the same time, Germany. And toward the end of the 19th century, American capitalism ascending. British capitalism threatened. German capitalism ascending. And it exploded in two world wars, World Wars I and II, that were, whatever else they were, a fight between the Americans, the British, and the Germans. And the Americans allied with the British to destroy the Germans. They had to do it twice to settle the matter. And by 1945, the end of World War II, the United States had emerged dominant, having destroyed both its parent, the British economy, by outmaneuvering it, and the Germans by physical destruction. And the United States capitalism, born, evolved over time, maneuvered, becomes the dominant capitalism of the world. after 1945, already a little bit after World War I, but really settling it after World War II, we are the dominant capital. We've really reached our peak. And the peak lasts for a while, as peaks often do. From roughly 1945 to roughly now, it's half a century, not bad. Kind of like the peak of the feudal absolute monarchies in France, England, and so on. And now, I would argue, it's coming to an end. Decline is setting in. And that's not a cause for alarm, and it's not a cause for weeping, and it's not a cause for thinking of disaster. All of those are possible. But if we're aware of the process and can think about it, we have a better chance of managing it. And in the second half of today's program, I'm going to talk about what that decline involves and how we might manage it. And you know, once you understand that that's a framework for analysis, you then, of course, begin to see all of the earlier signs. So I want to take us back to that period after World Wars I, and particularly after World War II, when the United States emerged as the top and most successful capitalist economy. From being born in that situation we talked about, to growth, to development, and then to dominance over the last almost century, certainly more than half a century. It is understandable that already early signs might have been missed, but they've now accumulated and they can't be missed anymore. And I want to talk a little bit about them so you get a sense of a process that we're caught up in and why we're experiencing the symptoms of a decline that needs to be understood as that. Well, after World War II, we were king of the hill. We had destroyed, or the war had destroyed, all conceivable competitors. Britain, Germany, Japan, Russia. They were all decimated by the war. We emerged almost unscathed. Excepting Pearl Harbor, no bombs fell in this country and did the damage that they did in all those other countries. But you know, defeated countries, broken countries, destroyed economies, they all rebuild. And by the 1970s, the defeated countries, particularly Germany and Japan, had indeed rebuilt and become capitalist powerhouses. In China, where a successful communist revolution in 1949 had the Soviet Union to look at, they made a decision not to go in certain directions that hadn't worked for the Soviets, to avoid their mistakes. And one of the big decisions the Chinese made was to become the powerhouse producer for the world economy, something the Russians didn't decide to do and probably couldn't have done given the politics. But the Chinese could, and the Chinese did, and they became the powerhouse relative to the United States that Russia never managed. You also had globalization, the great success of American capitalists leaving this country, finding cheaper workers and faster growing markets outside the United States. And that in turn meant that the capitalist lost interest in the United States. Why give money to a university in Kansas where you're not going to be hiring very many engineers when you can give scholarships in India or China or elsewhere, ending up with engineers trained pretty much the same way, but affordable for a fraction of the salary you'd have to pay an American. It begins the undermining. And of course, if businesses are focused elsewhere, then they pay taxes there, not here. And that means local governments and state governments don't get the kind of revenue from their capitalists that might have allowed them to continue to be supportive in the way they had once been. You begin to see it. Public education fades. Why? Again, why spend money to build public education here to produce expensive workers when capitalists can fund public education over there for much cheaper educated workforces? And you begin to see the erosion of the public sphere. And that's one of the reasons why we have had even more symptoms of decline as this process accumulates. No matter how much you blame Mr. Trump, it isn't all him that made us fail to be prepared for a virus, to be able to contain a virus. Likewise, we know that capitalism has a business cycle downturn every 4 to 7 years. We knew, therefore, that we were due for one, since the last one was in 2008 and 9. What did we do to prepare for it? Nothing. What did we do to contain it? Nothing. And then our worst nightmare, economic crash together with a public health disaster. And both of them could have been and should have been prepared for and managed, but they weren't. It's not because Americans aren't smart. It's not because Americans have forgotten their history, but their empire, their resources, their means of coping are being undermined. So too, the failed wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The impotence in the face of Venezuela and Bolivia that we would have in the past brushed aside and replaced with governments more favorable can't do it anymore. It's a problem. It's a serious decline. The share of world trade that is accounted for by the United States shrinks all the time. The U.S. dollar, which was once the global currency, is increasingly contested. The Chinese are moving in, the Russians and the Chinese together. The Middle Eastern oil producers want to escape from having to make all their deals in the role of the dollar internationally, so closely allied with that of the United States, is in trouble. Oh, it's not gone yet. We're not talking about collapse, but we are talking about decline. And now the mass of the American people are beginning to feel it and sense it too. The notion that the United States was a place where every generation lives better than the one before, that notion is dead. Many, many Americans feel bitter and angry. It's a major part of Donald Trump's support was coming from the people who feel betrayed. They experience the decline I'm talking about as a betrayal. Somebody has got to be to blame. Could it be immigrants? Could it be liberals? Could it be black and brown people? Who? The scapegoat opportunity is always there, and there's always a sleazoid politician who climb aboard the scapegoat train and ride it as far as he can. Trump is only the latest. But there's a lesson there to learn. There is something real going on, making people upset and angry and bitter and sometimes cruel and nasty. What is this? And you know, we have parallels. One parallel I'm going to give you is Germany. Too much happened to the German working class in too short a time, and it went crazy. Let me remind you. Germany was the ascending power at the end of the 19th century, like the United States, the powerful, rich, capitalist newcomer displacing the old, previously dominant British capitalist empire. And the Germans were successful, like the Americans, and began to really believe in themselves, like the Americans, and to imagine that they had a bright future, like the Americans. And then the United States and Britain allied and destroyed the German hope. In 1914, the Germans went to war thinking they'd win. In 1918, they had been defeated. They were destroyed. But that was only step one. In 1922 and 23, Germany experienced an inflation of the sort that the Germans had never seen before. In a matter of a few months, the exchange rate between German marks, that was their currency at the time, and the U.S. dollar went from 6 marks to a dollar to 10 billion German marks to the dollar. That's right. People were paid twice a day, ran home and gave their wives or husbands the pay in a bag of bills, and they ran to the store to spend them, because if they didn't spend them within an hour, they'd be worthless later that afternoon. That's how fast prices were rising. That's an inflation. Americans haven't seen it yet. And then, as if to wax a defeat in World War I and a catastrophic inflation. And by the way, what really did the Germans in was that inflation. Germans are very frugal to this day. They save a lot of money. They don't use credit cards. They don't go into debt like Americans. They never did. They save money. They've been saving for decades. But they were saving in marks. And in a few months in 1922-23, those marks became worthless. And all the savings accumulated by all the German families were worthless. They lost the war. They lost their future. They lost their savings. And in 1929, a few years later, the Great Depression hit and they lost their jobs. It was too much. In 10 years, everything was destroyed. And you know what happened to them? They decided that their savior would be this short little man with a funny dark mustache who claimed that the great people of the world were blue-eyed and blonde, even though he was neither. And they followed Adolf Hitler into a total and complete disaster. But they were desperate, and they were really suffering. And it isn't so hard to understand. Economic decline, especially when you're not prepared for it, is a social trauma. And we're living through it now. That's why there was a Trump. Here's the way it can go. When the decline sets in and you have to begin to face what that means, one reaction is denial. We are living in a country that is mostly about denial. Trump denies in one way, but Biden denies in another. One is going to make America great again, which is half an admission if you think about it. We have to go back because we're sliding. Biden says, oh, no, build back better. Well, there's the admission again, buried in the words. Yeah, something's wrong. Well, we lurched to the right, like the Germans did. We haven't paid the price the Germans did yet. And this latest election suggests maybe the majority of Americans are basically beginning to understand and are deciding not to go to the far right. They're going to try running down the middle. You know, Biden, the Democrats, neoliberalism, globalization, back to normal, 100 ways of saying it. But now here's a hopeful way to end this story. If the lurching to the right, which we just had 4 years of, didn't solve the problem, and let me underscore, it didn't solve the problem. Our economy is in worse shape than when Mr. Trump started. Our global position is poorer than when Mr. Trump started. Our public health is a disaster. Our economic future looks grim. Yeah, he didn't solve the problem of decline. And I'm here to tell you that there's nothing in Mr. Biden's program that offers any solution either. No question which is the better way to go. But if you're looking for a solution, if you're aware that we have a decline, then you will not find a solution in Mr. Biden either. It's as much of a prediction as I will make. But the good news, the silver lining in a cloudy spectrum of options, what we haven't tried in the United States is to go to the left, to be progressive, to do things that we have done that have worked in the past. The last time the United States faced decline, it was the collapse after 1929, when the Roaring Twenties gave us the depressed 30s. And in that moment, the American people rose up and they went left, creating Social Security, unemployment compensation, a federal jobs program, a minimum wage. And that got us out of the depression pretty well, not alone, but pretty well. And it was a better way to go. And that's my message to you. You can handle a decline. We're a rich country, but you have to be ready to admit it in order to solve it. It's a little bit like AA. You have to admit you have a problem as your first step in solving it. We are a declining economic power, and that either gets faced and managed in a humane way, or it drives us crazy into political and moral dead end. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to speaking with you again.
That was Professor Richard Wolff and a recent edition of Economic Update. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care.